Today's activity is not so much an experiment as a demonstration of a basic technique called electrophoresis. Now, electrophoresis is just one of several important separation techniques in science. It's often important to separate things on some basis, and depending on what's being separated and what you're trying to do with it, there are different techniques that can be used. What other scientific techniques are separation techniques that we've talked about? For instance, in the pink and blue experiment where they were trying to separate the protein or whatever got left behind in this from the cell and what got injected into the cell, what did they use to separate? Right, centrifugation is a separation technique. That separates things on the basis of size, because the heavier things will drop to the bottom and that forces the lighter things to the top. There's also distillation, for instance, which is how booze is made. Distillation is separation of components of a solution based on their different boiling points. So you very gradually, slowly heat something up that's a mixture of things with different boiling points, and whatever component has the lowest boiling point will boil off first. You collect that, and so on. Chromatography is another one that's very similar to electrophoresis, really, because it's things are moving at different speeds through some sort of medium. We don't do chromatography in here, but you have likely accidentally done it as a kid. If you were watercolor painting in kindergarten or whatever, I actually have no idea what they do in kindergarten anymore. It's been almost 60 years since I've done that. But if you accidentally drip watercolor paint onto a napkin, which you probably did as a kid, and then look at it later, it started as one color, but you'll see it come out as different colors, kind of like a rainbow in a circle, and that's because the one color is really a mixture of multiple colors, and each different color is a different size and travels through the napkin at different speeds, so you see it banding out. Very similar in electrophoresis. Electrophoresis is a separation technique that has three bases. It's based on three different properties, which are charge, electrical charge, shape, and size. All three of those things affect electrophoresis, but one of them is much more important than the other, and that's charge. What I mean by that is if you have a sample that is a collection of different things, whatever kinds of particles, and none of those particles has any electrical charge, then electrophoresis is not the technique for you, because none of them will move at all. At least some of them have to be charged in order for them to be separation. And that's because what happens in electrophoresis, which is what... Oh, damn it. I didn't start the trial, so I've been wasting time. Let me close this up real quick. You've loaded your samples into a dye, into a gel, and this is an electrophoresis chamber that I'm going to close here, and turn on the juice, so to speak. I'm going to give it 120 volts, make it a little faster. You don't want to give it a million volts or it'll just explode. But I'm supposed to give it 100. I'll give it 120. I'll make it travel a little faster. Anyway, let me make sure it's bubbling so that I don't waste time again. Yeah, it's working. Okay. The electrophoresis gel, which is lying in there horizontally, I'll draw vertically. it is subjected to a voltage. That's what I just turned on the power supply for. So a voltage is applied across the length of it. Negative up here, positive down here. And this is why at least some, not necessarily all, but at least some of the particles have to be charged. Because if there's no charged particles, they'll just stay where they are. They're not going to be attracted to either end, positive or negative. But if you do have some charged particles, then negatively charged particles are going to be attracted to the positive end, and positively charged particles are going to be attracted to the negative end. Simple as that. But that's where the other properties, the other two properties of the three I mentioned, come into play. Because larger molecules are going to have a harder time traveling through that gel, so they will be slower. They'll move in a direction that's determined by their charge, but they'll move at a speed that's partially determined by their size. The other thing that matters for speed, though, is the shape. So one analogy here is to imagine something you've probably done, which is walk through a swimming pool, deep water, like up to your neck. You can do it, not nearly as fast as you can walk in air, of course, right? Because it's a much denser medium that you're walking through. But you can do it. Well, if you then spread your hands out, you're no bigger. Your shape's different. That's going to make it even harder to get through there, right? It's more drag. So shape and size both matter. But if you don't have charge, there's no movement at all. Well, the wells that, both in your practice one and in the real gel back there, those are made simply when you pour the liquid that sets up as the gel. So it's really just like making gelatin, except gelatin is an animal product. This stuff is a polysaccharide that's made by algae. But it sets up like gelatin does. Anyway, when you pour it in the mold, the liquid, you then put what's called a comb. The comb is right here by the chamber. I just took it out of the gel. It's called a comb because it has little teeth. When you put that into the liquid, it'll form around it, and then you pull this out once it's set up, and those are the wells. So what I'm saying is that you can put those wells anywhere in the gel. Notice that this gel had them at the end, at one end. But you could have them, you could put them in the middle. Now, can you guess what conditions it would be appropriate to put the wells in the middle of the gel? Why would you want to do that ever?
When you have particles of different charges.
Exactly. If you either don't know what the charge is, which is one possibility, or you know that there's some positive ones and some negative ones, then you need to have room for them to go in either of two directions. Because the positive ones are going to move in one direction, the negative ones are going to move in the other direction. Okay? We didn't do that today, though, because we know very much about our sample. It's not an unknown sample. Our samples are DNA, right? From the owls. And it doesn't matter whether it's owl DNA or animal DNA or plant DNA or bacterial DNA, all DNA is charged. What kind of charge does it have, positive or negative? Yes, all DNA is negatively charged, and that's because of what?
Phosphate.
Right. Every nucleotide, which is just one monomer in the string, has to have a negative charge because it can't be a nucleotide without phosphate. And it doesn't matter how big the piece is, every little individual subunit is going to have a negative charge. And that's why for today's use of electrophoresis, for the electrophoresis trial that's running right now, we made a gel with the wells at the end. Now, I could have messed this up by putting it in the chamber the wrong way. If I would have put the wells at the positive end, the negative DNA that's in those wells would have been trapped to the positive, and they just would have spilled right off the edge of the gel, ruining it, right? So I have to have them, the gel placed so that the wells containing the negative DNA is at the negative end. They're going to be attracted to the positive end. An electrophoresis trial itself is really just like a race. Everyone is starting at the start line. The wells themselves are the start line. And then once the voltage is applied, charged particles are going to run away from the well in what's called a lane. This is a lane, just like a lane in a swimming pool. So each well corresponds to a lane. Now, what you put in the well is not a single particle, right? It's millions of particles. But if it contains different kinds of particles, then they'll travel at different speeds based on their shape and size. And so what you need to realize is that, because for a lot of people this seems counterintuitive, larger pieces move slower. So when you look at the final gel after the electrophoresis trial is complete, you should see what are called bands in the lane. And if you see two bands or more, the largest particles are the ones that didn't travel as far. This would be larger than this. Smaller ones get through the gel much easier and travel faster, therefore. All right. Now, you do this technique for whatever reason you want to separate charged particles. There's a lot of different reasons you'd want to do that. For today, we just want to get an answer to this owl DNA question. So in your manual, on page, it's probably 146, because it's just before the procedure. Yeah, on page 146, notice, and we haven't talked about sex chromosomes yet, but we will upstairs next week. Birds are similar to humans in how they use sex chromosomes, meaning that one sex has two of the same chromosome and the other has one of each of two different chromosomes, except it's flipped. Humans use the XY system, and females are the ones that have two of the same, an X and an X. Males have an X and a Y. Well, in birds, it's Z and a W. Also, the males, not the females, are the ones that have two of the same. You can see that in the little figure on page 174. A male has two Z's. A female has a Z and a W. The reason, though, that we can use electrophoresis to sex the owls from which the DNA was taken in your samples is because a Z chromosome, the section that we amplified by PCR last week, is bigger for Z than it is for W. Okay? Now, a band, importantly, a band on electrophoresis gel is not a single particle. If you had just one piece of DNA that you're putting in a well, you would not see it. As a matter of fact, there's a fairly good chance you won't see it even today with millions of them in there. But hopefully, it's kind of a crapshoot. Sometimes this works, sometimes it doesn't. But anyway, in order for you to actually see a visible band, you need many, many copies of the particle, which is exactly why we started last week with using a small sample of DNA from the owl and subjecting it to PCR so you could make millions of copies all identical and therefore all the same size. When you have a band that actually appears, that means you have millions of particles all running at the same speed because they're all the same size. But there's enough of them there that you see a nice band. And so getting good results is kind of a you have to get good at the technique. You don't want to overwhelm it. You don't want to give it trillions of copies, because then it'll just kind of be a foggy band. You don't want to give it too few, or you won't see the band. If you get the right number, though, you can get a band, and it'll look like a nice rectangular mark, like in the picture on the next page. But while you're running the trial, and you can come over and look at it if you want, but you don't see any bands while it's running in this version. The DNA is there. It's forming bands, but you can't see the bands because you have to subject it to ultraviolet radiation, which causes them to glow, kind of like the pig in the tobacco plant. So they're invisible. What's visible, though, that you can see is what's called the dye front. It's an orange line from the orange loading dye that you use. That has moved away from the welds, and it's going toward the other end of the gel. That's important, actually, because to get good results in an electrophoresis trial, you want to run the trial long enough so that there's good separation. If you stop it after a couple minutes, they won't separate from each other, the faster ones from the slower ones, that you'll see them as distinct bands, right? So you want to run it as long as possible. But on the other hand, you don't want to walk away and come back the next day, because they'll just spill right off the other end. So you want to run it as long as you can so that there's maximal separation. But they're invisible. That's why it's important that you can see the dye front. Because the dye front is made up of particles that are smaller than any of your samples. And they therefore travel faster than the DNA does. So what you practically do in that case is, if you really want real good results, is to run this until the dye front gets almost all the way to the edge. That way you know that the DNA is still on there. It hasn't spilled off, because the DNA has to be behind the dye. We're not going to let it go all the way, because we don't really need to today. There's only a maximum of two bands. Sometimes you have multiple bands, many bands within the same lane. That's why you'd really want to be careful about spacing them out. But I'm going to let it run for until it's about halfway at least, and hopefully we'll get some images. But anyway, back to this owl DNA. If your randomly chosen owl last week was a male, all of the DNA in your sample will be the same size, because it has a Z and a Z and they're identical. So you'd see only one band. But if it's a female, you have a Z and a W, different sizes, you'll have two bands. Now, I drew two bands here, so this would have to be a female, right?